boys and girls. Welcome to the Cool Kids Lunch Table Podcast with PJ and Mike. Now find yourself a seat at their table.
Hey kids, I'm Mike.
I'm PJ.
And today we'll be talking about the process of writing a novel, becoming an author, and the day in the life of being a poet. And to help us out, we'll be interviewing author and poet John Yamras to discuss his new books, his new memoir, The Street, and the volume of poetry entitled People and Other Bad Ideas. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. This is really interesting. You guys introduced me as talking about how to write a novel. That's a bit of a lie, because in the course of my 39 published books, I did write and publish two novels, but they were really, really shitty. And the only thing I learned and the only thing I could teach from them is that I am not a novelist. So I could teach you about writing books of poetry, but I can't teach you about the process of writing a novel.
That's no problem. But I'm going to read a little bit for the folks at home more about John. So John has been working as a writer for over five decades. His first book came out in 1970. Since then, he published 39 books, mostly poetry, but including two novels, three memoirs, and a children's book. Several of his books have been appeared in translation. Many of his poems have been taught in dozens of college courses, and also been included in textbooks. His most recent books, like we're going to talk about today, are his volume of poetry, People and Other Bad Ideas, and his new memoir, The Street. Very exciting. Then PJ is going to give us a little quick synopsis of each.
So we have here is The Street. That's your newest book, right, John, is The Street?
Well, they came out within a week of each other, kind of joined at the hip.
All right, because we have here The Street is ostensibly about the street where you grew up and about your childhood years, but it does encompass much more than that. It's a postmodern and often meta approach to storytelling. You show us what it was to live in a blue-collar town, coal town, in the Northeast, which may have been any working-class town anywhere in America, while at the same time obliquely discussing the nature of memory and consciousness, what it means to perceive through limited lens of ourselves. Also, because you're approaching your memoir through a flash fiction vignettes rather than an overarching narrative, creates a memory of a place more than an event or series of events. I think it's a very interesting idea. And then your other book is called The People and Other Bad Ideas, which is another collection of poems. And these poems ain't your blue-haired grandma's poems. You have to read them at your own risk. I love that. I think that's pretty funny. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the interview, let's just start with our childhood memory like we like to do. So, John, why don't you start off? Can you just tell us your favorite book that you read in high school or in your past, really? It could be any time. It doesn't have to be high school.
Well, you know, I just finished writing a 10-part series of articles on classic literature. And one of those 10 featured Treasure Island.
Oh. Oh.
You know, we all read that as kids, but I read it again just a couple of weeks ago as an adult, and I just absolutely loved it. And, you know, right on the first page, you got yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, and I was sucked right back into it. So, you know, that brought back some childhood memories for me. And as a writer, memory is my stock in trade. You know, we a childhood memory. I remember riding a bike as fast as I could down to the corner, and a tricycle. And you know how tricycles take corners. So I would always hit that corner and end up on my ass. And I ended up writing about that bicycle and my ass and that corner. So, you know, childhood memories, that's my stock in trade.
Yeah, so for me, When I was a kid, I always read comic books, right? We've spoken about that on our show tons of times. I'm a comic book kid. That was what I always read, to the point where I have a comic book store of my own now, right? That's what I do because I love comic books. Yeah. But in high school, I remember one of the books we read was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Love it.
And that became my favorite book because my favorite superhero is Superman. And I felt like Atticus had the qualities of a Clark Kent.
Oh, you know? He was. And I always, whenever I think of that book, I think of Jet dressed up as the Ham for Halloween.
Right, yep.
Oh, great scene.
So that was always one of my favorites because I related it to the comic books that I loved reading. He had that sense of morality, right and wrong, fairness. And that was Superman in a nutshell to me. So when I read that book, and then even when I saw the movie, I looked at him like he could be Clark Kent. He looks like what Clark Kent's supposed to look like. Yeah. He acts like he's supposed to act. And that's what made me like that book so much. I couldn't bring myself to read the second one. I forget the name of it now.
That was a mess. There's a reason why she didn't.
Go Set a Watchman. That's right. What it's called. Yeah. I couldn't bring myself to read it. I heard nothing but bad things, and I love the original, and I couldn't bring myself to read that one.
Yep.
Yeah, good pick, PJ. For me, I picked another old school one, The Great Gatsby. You know, I just always loved that book, man. I think I read it in my junior year of high school, and to this day, I always think about that book from like looking for green lights. So I think in part of the book, he remembers his own birthday, Nick Carraway, and you know, was it Mr. Wilson, and like something at the billboard, he sees the eyes. So like, I feel like that book.
The glasses. Is, oh
yeah, that's it. Yeah, I just feel like, man, like it's so damn good. So
you bring it up. I talked about that 10 article series I did on classics, and To Kill a Mockingbird and Gatsby, they're both on there. And you know, those are just essential reading. And if people aren't reading them and familiar with them, they're really missing out. But in preparing, and I do, it may not sound like it, but I do prepare for these interviews and things. And preparing it, I looked up what you two do. And you guys talk about movies a lot. And I love movies. And I wanted to ask you, PJ, off the top of your head, what's your favorite movie of all time?
Clerks.
Clerks. Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Doesn't even take much. I don't have to think of it. That's been my favorite movie since I saw it in the 90s.
Wow.
And I think I've probably spoken about it on some older episodes, but the reason I got so sucked into that movie was the subject matter they spoke about in the movie, right? Throughout the whole thing is Star Wars. It's superheroes. It was things that like me and Mikey would talk about in our lives, like every day. Yeah. And then all of a sudden here comes this movie and it's a small picture. It's a small budget. It's not a blockbuster by any stretch, although it's gone on to become a huge cult classic. But when I watched them, like, it was like listening to myself.
Yeah. Then,
like, these are the things that I say. These are the things that I sound like. And I got so enthralled with that. And I watched that movie and I said, well, if this guy, before I knew who Kevin Smith was, but I said, if this guy can make a movie, maybe one day I can. I actually went to film school because I saw that movie.
Wow.
And I felt like I was that inspired by it because, again, it's nothing. It's no spectacle to watch in terms of cinematography or anything like that, but it's so relatable, and the dialogue and the writing on that movie is just so perfect. You know, it's for its time, it was perfect, but even looking back at it now, it's still relevant.
Still holds up.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
There's a joke in that movie that I laugh at because it takes place in the convenience store, and this was again the early 90s, right? So one of the customers in that convenience store buys a coffee and he drinks it and it's hot, and he goes, you mean I have to drink this coffee hot? And you laugh about it now because iced coffee is a thing, but back then you couldn't get an iced coffee. So it's just
do you know that there was a not a knockoff, but a movie made on the same premise a few years later called Inconvenience, you know, like in a convenience store. Mm-hmm. And if Clerks was low budget, this was a low, low, low budget, and it was called Inconvenience. Really, that was interesting too, but it was a pretty much a ripoff of Clerks.
Wow, I haven't seen that one, but yeah, that is my favorite movie. And he's a, when we talk about writers, I mean, yeah, it's a movie, but there's a lot of writing obviously that goes into it, and I think he's one of the best writers out there. He just doesn't get the credit he deserves, Kevin Smith. But yeah, that's my favorite. What's your favorite movie, John? Since you asked me, I'll ask it right back to you.
Well, probably There's probably three. Of course, Casablanca.
Mm-hmm. You know, oh, yeah.
Everybody loves that. Another one that's near the top is The Thing. Not the remake. The one from 1951.
Yeah.
I love that. That had overlapping dialogue. You know, you had to really listen to it. And for a low-budget, semi-low-budget movie, it had layers of action. You could see business going off in the background and in the background of the background. It was really, really well done. And my all-time favorite movie is probably On the Waterfront.
Oh, okay.
And, of course, the scene in the taxi cab is probably, for my money, the greatest 6 or 7 minutes ever put on screen, ever.
Well, those are three classics right there, yeah.
But you're talking about great writing put on film. Just for the writing, it has to be Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Edward Elgar.
Another classic, yeah.
Mike Nichols, the way he...
Oh, yeah.
He made a lot of enemies putting that movie together, but it was worth it. It's a great movie, and it holds up today. How many, 40 years later, 50 years later?
So yeah, at least, yeah.
Yeah. 1967, I think it came out. But interestingly, Albee's play came out in 62, kind of just at the end or the height of, you know, Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet and all that stuff. And then here comes Albee's play. And at the same time, there was a book called Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates. If you're not familiar with it, pick it up. Yates, it was made into a movie a few years ago with Leonardo DiCaprio.
It was a great movie, yeah.
Yeah, it flopped, but it was a great movie. And if you ever have a chance, read the book by Richard Yates. It's better than the movie. And for my money, Yates was the best writer of dialogue of any writer I've ever encountered.
So that brings me to a question for you then, John. How did you get into being a writer? Like, what made you want to be a writer? Was it a book you read? Was it just something that clicked one day for you?
What clicked was girls.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was a way for me to meet girls. You could tell I'm a little guy, you know, so I wasn't on the football team or the basketball team. So it was my way to get to meet girls. And I found out that was the one little talent I had. So, so that's how I became a writer. And the way I actually got my foot in the door as a writer, and I've told this story a million times, is I lied my way into a career.
Got to figure to make it.
True. I was starting out with my friend who was also an aspiring writer. And we were both bitching about how we couldn't get published anywhere because whenever we sent our work out, publishers would say, "This is nice, but where have you been published before? And what awards have you won?" And of course, the answer was always nothing and nothing.
Yeah.
So one night, we had just reached the bottom of a bottle of cheap pop-off vodka. I don't know if you remember pop-off vodka or if they even sell it anymore.
Yep, they still do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. we had reached the bottom of a fifth of vodka, and we were talking about how we couldn't get published anywhere. And he looked up at the street sign, and it was Oliver and Wakefield Streets. And he looked at the sign and he handed me the bottle of vodka and said, "I hereby award you the Wakefield Prize." True story. Next day, I sent off some poems to a magazine, pretty prestigious magazine at the time. It's now out of business. I sent them off and I said, "I've recently been awarded the Wakefield Prize. hoping you'd take a look at my poems." I forgot about it. 3 weeks later, I get it. I was going to say email. I get a piece of mail back from the editor of the magazine saying, "I heard about you recently winning the Wakefield Prize. We'd love to publish your poems." And that's the true story of how I got my foot in the door as a writer. And I've been making stuff up ever since.
That's awesome. Well,
that's great. I wish I was deceitful enough to have thought of that. Years back, I had submitted to an independent comic book company an idea that I had for a comic book. I can't draw worth a shit, but I like to write a little bit. Certainly never got anything published. I never went that far with it. But I had an idea, and there was an independent company looking for people to write some stories for an anthology book they were coming out with. So I had a few ideas for a few short comic books or whatever. I sent it to them. They wouldn't publish it because for the same reason. Well, who are you? We don't know who you are. And they wouldn't even bother looking at it. So, yeah, I wish I was clever enough to thought about just lying about it. That's a great idea.
I wasn't clever. I was just drunk and desperate.
Yeah. And sometimes that's all it takes. And you started off writing poetry right from the beginning. That was your thing.
Yes. Yes. And I talked about those two bad novels that I published. That first novel, to talk about the art of suggestion. That first novel, when I sent it off to the publisher, who had already published two books of my poetry, and how the novel came about, was saying, well, the poems are selling okay, but we could do better if we had a novel. So I wrote up a novel really quick, you know, fascinated by Kerouac. I wrote it up real fast, kind of like Kerouac. And being a two-finger typer, I typed the thing, the whole novel, in lowercase. And since I was hot to trot and hot to get it to the publisher, I sent it off as I wrote it in lowercase. The publisher thought that I intended it to be published that way, in lowercase. Book came out. Book didn't sell much, but one review that I'll never forget talked about the lowercase writing, and it talked about the lowercase personal pronoun I, and it talked about the significance of me using the lowercase I to talk about the diminishing role of the individual in society, which the only intent I had was I could only type with two fingers, so that's the only intent I had with that lowercase I.
That's amazing.
That's the only thing I ever learned about my two novels, is that they taught me I'm not a novelist.
Yeah, John, I want to get to know John through our emails setting up this interview. And I before this, I says, you know, John, you remind me of a movie, I'm gonna toot my own horn, guys. I was totally accurate. So, John. Reminds me of Mr. Keating from Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams' character. And then, John, you just said, you know, reasons why you became a writer is because you want to get women. And this is a quote from the film. This is actually two quotes I want to talk about. This is the first one.
He's not very tired. He is exhausted. And don't use very sad use. Come on, Mr. Overstreet, you twerp.
Morose?
Exactly, morose. Now, language was developed for one endeavor, and that is Mr. Anderson. Come on, are you a man or an amoeba? Mr. Perry.
To communicate.
No! To woo women. Today we're going to be talking about William Shakespeare.
Oh, God.
I know. A lot of you look forward to this about as much as you look forward to root canal work.
But John, I'm really proud of myself. My instincts were correct. And I'm just curious, have you seen Dead Poets Society? And do you agree with my?
You know, I haven't seen it. It's one of those movies I always wish I had, but I totally agree with it. And I think when we were getting that little feedback and fumbling, that was probably you trying to find that quote.
Yes. Yep. But yeah, John, I'm kind of curious. Just, I want to kind of get into your books now, especially The Street. So I didn't read all of it, but I did a lot of it. So I guess, what made you want to write this memoir? Like, how did, you know, this is The Street we're talking about. And I think it was actually released on when I got married on November 3rd, which I felt like this was like, talk about cosmic connection. But yeah, what inspired you to kind of write this book? And I want to talk about certain things inside this book that I really want to pick more of your brain about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the book, you know, with my background of being a writer of poetry, and I refuse to call myself a poet, but I'm a writer of poetry. Edgar Allan Poe and Walt Whitman are poets. I'm just a writer of poetry.
Gotcha.
But this is basically a poem with a thyroid condition. it's as PJ talked about, the book is a little different than a normal memoir. It's not linear in any way. It's more like jazz. It kind of bounces around and builds on one idea and bounces in another direction. It's kind of like a game of pool. I was reading today. I do read occasionally. No, I'm constantly reading. I was reading today that before Cézanne and his landscapes before Cézanne always had a way into the painting. There was always a way for the viewer, the audience, to get into the painting. And with Cézanne, there was the paintings just were, and the viewer, the audience, had to jump into the painting and become part of it. And that really hit me, because that's kind of the way I look at my poetry, that people have to jump into it and become part of the experience. And I talk about the thing that kind of kicked off that whole thing for me, because as you said, I've written 39 books, but I probably had published a good 10 or 12 books before I knew what the hell I was doing. And my aha moment was a very short 17-word poem. It went like this. "Write a poem about that," she said, sitting on the edge of the bed, smiling. And before I wrote that poem, previous to that, I would have continued writing and writing and writing, describing what all that was. But like Cézanne's paintings, I wanted the audience to jump into the poem and become part of the experience, to join with me in that feeling, and whatever they could imagine in their heads describing whatever that was so much more powerful than what me as a stupid writer could come up with. And once I figured that out, that was a really powerful moment for me as a writer. That was my aha moment. I'm talking to you guys.
That's okay.
No, it's great. Yeah, we want to hear what you have to say, so it's great. Yeah, there was a line in the street that stuck out to me, and I'll just bring it up. You had wrote in here that you said, "I read somewhere once that the dream is always killed by reality." And then you went on, you know, and you talked a little bit more, but just that first sentence, I guess I read it at the right time when that was sent to me when I was going through it, because like I mentioned, having a comic book store, and that was always a dream of mine, right? And when I read that, I had a particularly trying day dealing with some distributors and stuff at the comic book store. And I sat there and I finished up with the store. I was closed and I was reading it. And then I read that line, "The dream is often killed by reality." And I had such a bad day where I like slammed my laptop closed at the end of the day. And I'm like, I can't believe this is what I always wanted to do for my entire life, and this is the bullshit I have to deal with. And then I read that line, and then I continued to read it, and I got lost a little bit in the book, and I kept going from there. But I just, that line struck me, and I guess it just came at the right time, because here I am doing the one thing I've always wanted to do, and I'm so aggravated by it. But when I read that in the book, it just kind of like snapped me out of it. And I was like, wait a minute, but this is a dream. So I just wanted to tell you that while we were talking, because that did stick out to me as something that at that moment, I don't think there was another sentence I could have related to more. I just wanted to tell you that, because I thought you might appreciate it.
More than you know, as a writer, you live for those kind of comments. You know, being a writer is really a lonely occupation, if you want to call it an occupation, and hearing things like that really, really makes you feel good. So thank you.
I thought it was perfect when just for that moment, it really helped. So,
John,
go ahead, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I want to talk about certain things about your book, and you talked about memories, and I want to read this from your book as well. So you said that memories are like leaves on a tree. And they fall at different times, at different speeds, in different ways. Eventually, no matter how they fall, they end up covering the ground. And kind of like you said, your book is kind of like this jazz thing. And I'm going to kind of just go down these things that I just loved about the street. And I think, PJ, actually, just, you might like this part. I'm sure you got this part in the book. But you talk about Black Mary, which was kind of like this figure, kind of like maybe the Boo Radley of your of your neighborhood. That, you know, I guess it was like an urban legend. If you looked at her,
yeah, exactly.
if you looked at her, you would turn to stone. And I think we all have kind of have those neighbors or people in our neighborhood somewhere in some other town. I remember, Pete, you remember this house? I think it was in Massapequa, and the whole house was red. The sidewalk was red. Everything was red. You used to have candles in there.
Yep.
Used to
the Truett House. Yep.
Yeah, that one. Mm-hmm. And I think another part of the book I really enjoyed too, I think all of us, especially boys, some girls can play with balls too, but how going to that, you talk about your neighbors had this fenced in yard. It was like nothing got held. They had a fence and held nothing in, but held nothing out as well. Like kept nothing out either.
Yep.
And I really found
wire.
Yep. Another part for me that was just kind of very just deep, but I feel like it felt like very cinematic for me. It was like how you, passing on your father, how, you know, especially you described later on the book, he was almost like a relief pitcher, the way he walked, you know, and, you know, he was a coal miner, and I think he changed careers, and he died very young, like 45, and just the way you, and when you found him, you know, I don't want to spoil the book here, folks, but the way you found him, like, in the, just the imagery that you just spoke in the words, you kind of get going back to it, I was just like, it's just very powerful, you know, the way you wrote that narrative, so, I just really, like I said, I keep going on and on about your book, but that section really for me, you know, about your father and finding him and, you know, and it's really, I feel that I was there. You know, I felt I was with you, and not to sound more, but almost finding him, you know, dead. I feel like I was there with you, kind of holding your hand, finding him.
Yeah. Boy, thank you. You know, you're making this old writer feel good. I want to read a poem from my book, Selected Poems, The Director's Cut.
Yeah, sure.
If I could. And that book, it's interesting. The book was going to be published, and the publisher wanted to do a 550-page retrospective of the best of my 52 years as a writer. And I said, 550 pages, you're nuts. You're going to lose your shirt. Nobody's going to want to buy 550 pages worth of poetry, much less my shit. And so we fought about it. And I got him down to a 384-page book. He published it, and it became his best-selling title up to that point. And he said, come on. Now you got to let me do it. Let's restore the book and do it the way I intended, 550 pages. And we fought for another couple of months, literally 2 months. And I gave in, and he published a 542-page expanded edition, which cinematic lover that I am, we called it Selected Poems, The Director's Cut. And Selected Poems, The Director's Cut came out and for one day became number one on Amazon in poetry.
Whoa.
Wow.
And so I was really happy about that. Let me read just one poem.
Of course.
Sure. Of course.
Selected
yeah.
Poems, The Director's Cut. And a lot of my poems are about my wife. You grow up writing about girls, and you grow old writing about girls. And the girl of my life is my wife. And here's a poem about her. You are a bowl of popcorn, a slim book of poems and laughter during a moment of silence. You are pink bubble gum, a goddamn fool, and the only person in the world I care about. You are a clock with no hands, a blue bedroom, and a $20 bill. You refuse to accept the inevitable. You own way too many dresses, and you don't shoot pool. You are as uncomplaining as the sea. Ultimately, no one could put you into words, not even me.
Beautiful.
Very, very. You could feel the emotion in it. Obviously, you really care about the subject that you were writing about there. You can tell.
Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of a good segue because, I definitely am a believer in destiny. So maybe this is because I was writing back John back and forth setting this up. He wrote me a poem that he just came up with Tommy, which I may all read later on. But then he wrote this. Because I'm curious about where that poem kind of come from. Because you wrote to me, I titled this little excerpt, Inspiration versus Consistency. He says, one other thing you might touch on is my instance that a writer has got to stay busy. Those writers who say they're not writing because they're waiting for inspiration are boneheads and unprofessional in their approach to the craft. I write every morning. Most of it is shit that ends up getting thrown out, but I write every morning. And in that poem, was that inspiration? Was that something you were really kind of like chiseling at? I feel it was like a big slab of marble and you were, you know, kind of carving it out.
You know, like I said, I just write every morning, and the good stuff, you guys know it. You, when it's good, you know immediately.
Oh, yeah.
When something's good.
Yeah.
You hear all the time, you hear musicians talk about, I didn't write that. I just happened to be there when it was passing by, and I grabbed it and wrote it down.
Yep.
So that's how I feel, and that's why I come down here in my basement every morning. I want to be there to be able to grab that stuff when it's passing by and write it down. And if I'm not down here, I'm missing out. I run into those aspiring writers. I'll say, what are you doing now? You know, what's next? And they'll go, and they'll get all, you know, self-important, and they'll say, well, I'm not doing anything right now. I'm waiting for inspiration. And I want to punch them in the face, because if you're waiting for inspiration, you're not being very professional and you're not treating the work with respect.
Mm-hmm.
So you said something interesting there that I was actually going to ask you about. Two things, actually. One, that you have a dedicated space carved out for where you're going to do your writing. You said in your basement, and you write every morning. Is that something that you feel you have to do? You have to be in your writing space, and you have to be in your writing time to be productive?
Good question. No. The answer is no. I make the time and the place to do the writing, but, you know, it happens anytime. You'll get inspired. I'll wake up in the middle of the night and run down here and write something down real quick, but I at least try to put myself in the position to succeed. You know, baseball players go out and catch grounders for 2 hours a day. You just got to practice. You guys got me feeling like you mentioned that poem, Tommy.
Yes.
The new one, which will be in my next book. And I wanted to read another one that was written just this morning. She looked like someone who needed to be posing for a statue, like a scene out of an old movie. She stood there on the side of the road, lit a smoke, and blew him a kiss while he put the car in gear and drove away. That's it. The poems usually don't have any point. They're just little snapshots, like a little window onto what's happening, and I let the reader figure it out. And you mentioned Tommy.
Yes.
Let me read that one to you too.
Yeah, I have it printed out, but yeah, I'd rather you read it better than me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tommy didn't know where he first heard it, and he didn't much care, because it described him perfectly. And whenever anyone would ask him how he was doing, he'd stop and say, I started out with nothing and still got most of it left.
I love that last stanza, man. That, man, so good. So good.
That'll be in the next book.
Great.
Well, one of the things I appreciated while going through, you know, some of the books is it was very easy to read.
Yep.
And that's a big thing for me. I have the attention span of a goldfish on crack, right? I can't, as soon as someone jingles a set of keys, I'm gone. And I found, and you mentioned it again, you were just saying how, you know, they're short. And that's something that for me is great because I can read a few things, get a complete picture of what I read. If I put it down, I can come back to it. And I always appreciate writing that's like that. You know, everyone will tell you how great Lord of the Rings is and how great War and Peace is and all these other things. I can't get through a book that long with that many words. I can't get through a poem that's pages and pages long. I need something that grabs my attention and it gets me from start to finish in a reasonable amount of time before my brain takes me somewhere else. And I found that your books were like that. They weren't hard to get through. There wasn't, I had this be on, you know, in this book dived in for an hour, 2 hours straight just to get through it. And I appreciate a writing style like that. And you don't see, I feel like you see less and less of that because I think people want to feel good about themselves and show how many words they put out in a book sometimes. And I think sometimes less is more. And I felt like I got that from a lot of what I was reading.
Well, thank you. I want the poems to work on two levels. I want them to, you know, when you're sitting on the can and you read a poem or two and you get a smile and it hits you immediately. And I want that same poem to later on when you're opening a can of beer in front of the fridge to go, holy shit, that's what he meant. So yeah. I want them to hit you on two different levels. And, you know, they and I appreciate that you could recognize it, that they sound readable and relatable. And Jack Kerouac once said that walking on water wasn't built in a day. Mm-hmm. And what he meant was that making it look easy is not that easy.
Oh, yeah.
It's certainly not. Yeah.
Yeah. I know we're going to be running up against time here, but I wanted to read one more short one.
Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah. We have plenty of time. Yeah.
Again, another short one. It says, he said, it's like that moment just before drowning. You're not under the water and you're not out of the water. The only thing you know is you're not dead yet.
So,
no, PJ, I have this one. Sorry, I get to tell. I'm sorry, PJ. I don't want to forget. So, in my emails with John, he sent me, and PJ, you'll appreciate this. So, he sent me, so he wrote, John wrote poems, and then this Swedish artist, hopefully I'm pronouncing their name correctly, Jan Carlson. I mean, that's how I'm pronounced.
I think it's Jan, but.
Jan, that probably makes sense. So, Jan Carlson. And I guess when I post the video, I'll put up the artwork. But I'm just curious. Like, how does it feel to see, like, Peter? You're like, I mean, you've written stories, but to see someone else take your writing and then they create it and they make an image out of it. I'm like, how does that feel? And like, I mean, my God, I mean, is that what you envisioned too? Like, I mean, you know, how was it? You know,
that was Jan and I did a book together called As Real as Rain.
Mm.
Unfortunately, it was the biggest flop either he or I ever had, but we still loved it. The premise was he went through my published books and he picked out a shitload of poems and he illustrated them. And, you know, he put his take on the poems and it was like this. We just loved the result, but readers didn't know what to make of it. It was not. Since it was illustrated, it wasn't a kid's book, and adults thought it was a kid's book, so nobody bought it, and the book died. But so, I'm still very proud of that, and I hope one day it'll get reprinted.
So that actually brings as a great segue to the question I wanted to ask you. You said it's not a kid's book, but adults saw illustrations and felt like it was a kid's book, but you wrote a children's book, right? Did you feel like you had to change how you write to make it more palatable for kids? Or did you write the same way, but the subject matter just happened to be something more relatable for children?
Good point. And yes, it was a more relatable subject, but when I wrote it, I wanted it to be, you know, I aimed high. I wanted it to be like The Little Prince. I wanted it to be, it was the story of two dogs, Phoebe and Edo. And it was about the Phoebe thought she was a princess, not a dog. And it was about her learning that her doghood, being herself, was a very important thing. And that was my premise for my kids' book. I enjoyed writing it. I had a lot of fun writing it. I'll never write another one again because it was very, very difficult.
I was going to say that I feel like that would be harder to write for a children's book, because having to keep finding something that would keep a child interested and keep reading, the subject matter has to be appropriate. The language has to be a way that's understandable for kids. I feel like that would be an impossible task, and I can't self-edit myself down enough to be appropriate for kids. So I can imagine how difficult that would be.
Yep. I'm happy just writing my crappy little poems and putting them out in the world and seeing what happens.
Well, you call them crappy little poems, but I would say that they're much better than that, if you ask me. Not that I'm any authority on the subject.
Just going back to your book, The Streets, just other things I feel like I just have to get this out, just in terms of just, man, I just talk about like your grandparents and like just seeing her, like your mother, your grandmother with her hair down. She almost looked like a different person, you know? And I think like, you know, with my own grandparents, they're almost like a different like being, they're almost like mythology, you know, like
these
mythology creatures, you know what I mean? Like they're from a different time period, you know what I mean? And they look different. They're from a different fashion. Everything is different. And they're just like, you know, like, I mean, all my grandparents have passed away. So it's like a time machine for sure. And like, just the way you wrote about it was really beautiful, man. You know,
you know, I was thinking about that the other day. I'm 73 now. I can remember as a kid, and this just blew me away. As a kid, I could remember people who were born in the 1800s. Think about that.
Whoa. Right. Wow. Yeah. And you also talk about, oh no, go on, John, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. I want to read something else from the book.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, please.
Another bad please ideas. And well, no premise, I'll just read it. It's called The University Poet. The University Poet had a beard and wore a t-shirt that read "Going Nowhere Fast." He read his poems with intensity and leaned against the bookshelf, stroking his beard and pausing in all the wrong places. His students loved him. The young girls thought he was hot, and he had an apartment down the street filled with an unfinished novel, dirty dishes, and dreams that would never come true. I enjoyed this book, People and Other Bad Ideas. I was the publisher of the previous book of poems, 24 poems. I was doing a podcast with her. They run a show, and she was talking about all my new stuff being all portraits of people. And she said, that should be your next book. And so I said, yeah, People, that's a great idea for a title. And she said, yeah, but you got to come up with a subtitle. So that's where And Other Bad Ideas came from.
I think it's a great name.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Let me do one more. You guys are paying the price now. You got me going. Here's one. Her mouth was a ruined white flower. She had to be 80 or more. But she stood there in the back of the room while I read my poems to a couple of dozen students who only looked tired and bored. I wasn't into it, and neither were they, and all I could see was this mop of stringy gray hair and a face that kept urging me on. That's my book, People.
Yeah.
You wrote a couple of times about teaching in those, right? Do you teach poetry? Do you do any sort of adjunct professoring in a...
No. I went to one semester of college.
Wow.
So that's as far as my education went. But I guess I'm self-taught. I read constantly. My wife says I've always got my nose in a book. But no, I never taught, and I don't have the patience to do it. How about you guys?
As a teacher, no. I'm not a teacher. my brother is. He's much more patient than I am.
Yeah.
I've done some training in a professional setting in the business world. I've done a lot of training and facilitating, which is sort of close, I guess, to doing any sort of teaching. And I hate every minute of it.
Yeah.
It's not for me.
It's tough. It really is. I don't know how people can do it.
I don't know how they can do it either. And I'm the kind of person where you don't want to learn from me, because most of the time what I'm doing, whether it gets a positive or negative result, I'm just making it up as I go along. There's really no rhyme or reason for what I'm doing. I just hope for the best. So you don't want to learn from someone like me, because you're not going to get a real roadmap of how to be successful. It's just going to be a lot of running into the tree until it falls down instead of running around it, I guess.
Well, that's a good point. Making it up as you go along. That's kind of my way of doing the poetry, because whenever I sit down and write something, whether it's a poem or a longer piece, if I have a point A and a point B figured out ahead of time, it never works out. But like jazz, if I let it follow its own route, you know, like water going down a hill, then it's more successful. I've learned to trust my gut and to just let the words and let my own inner self tell me words to go. Excuse me.
Yeah, I think, which is a good segue, because I do teach. I mean, I'm a therapist, but on certain nights I teach coping skills, dialectical behavior therapy. And one of the things, like, maybe you're very anxious and you're kind of getting, you don't want, you can do some grounding techniques and stuff. There's tons of different kinds. But one of them, I work with substance use disorder folks and coworkers. That's mental health and they're suffering from substance use. But we talk about the serenity prayer, which is a form of poetry. You know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, you know? So even that can be very grounding for folks. So, I'm not teaching things like textbooky, but, you know, but for some folks, those kind of poetry can definitely, for a lot of folks, writing to how they feel, you know, journaling for sure can really help.
Yeah, it could be very cathartic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm reading a book right now by Anatole Breuard called Kafka Was the Rage. It's a memoir of New York City in the 1940s. Really interesting. I think you might enjoy that.
Yeah. There's two other poems that I want to read. I think one of them is printed, so I'm going to not read that one, but I love that one. This one is called He Found Her. It's a short one. He found her, far less glamorous and far more extreme than any woman he'd ever known. He was attracted, he was repelled, and he never could figure out why. Man, I've been there, brother. I'm married now, but I get that, man. Shit, you know? And
thank you.
Yeah, and I think you have another, my kind of, the way it printed out came out a little weird, but I like this one a lot because it's called Every Man. Maybe I will read it. It might be a quick, might be a little typo, but I used to be in a band, but our singer, you know, I used to write lyrics. My brother did, but our singer was really, very excellent. He was like, basically like you, could really write poetry. And anyway, we had a song called Every Man, different, but yours. And like I said, this is misprinted. I apologize. But so every man loves the smell of his own farts. Billings was different. His were so bad, he had to get up and leave the room. That's probably why he never got married. It was horrible. No woman stayed very long. Even his dog ran away twice, which is okay with Billings. He didn't mind being alone. He liked being quiet, and it gave him time to think. No one liked his music either. His life for Billings was almost perfect if he could only get used to the smell of his own farts. Oh, man. Yeah. I love it, you know, and I think John and our emails going back and forth. You got a flair for comedy, man. You know, so I really encourage you to keep going that route, man.
Well, you know, that's for guys who write poetry, the ones who call themselves poets. They take take themselves too seriously. I take the work seriously, but I don't take myself seriously. And I can make the same point by making the reader smile and then go, aha, that's what he meant. You know, so throwing a little humor into that is a big aid, a big help for me.
I can definitely see that. I have one more question for you, actually, because you said you were reading a book. Now, when you're writing, do you continue to read other books that come out or other books of poetry or novels? Or do you stop reading stuff so that you can make sure whatever thoughts you have are your own and it's not influenced by what you're reading?
That's a good point. Early in my career, I used to stop. And just through habit and getting good at what I'm doing, I don't have to stop anymore. I can separate those two things. So I can continue reading, whether I'm reading Proust or whether I'm reading Stephen King. It doesn't matter. The writing, my writing, stays true to me. And that's always, when I talk to kids who want to be writers, I say, it's very important for you to have develop a voice. The best example I could give is, you know, a musician. When you hear Carlos Santana, you know it's Santana.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or if you hear BB King, you know it's BB King. You have to get a voice. And for a writer, you can tell when it's Stephen King that you're reading, or you can tell when you're reading James Joyce. Those people have voices, and I've tried to develop my own voice, and I think I'm starting to get there.
Yeah, so John, before we wrap up, like I said, I just want to end with this quote from that film, Dead Poets Society.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race, and the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, oh me, oh life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, oh me, oh life? Answer that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
But John, that's like, look, that's your spirit, man. You know, just so your homework assignment at the lunch table is to watch that movie, okay? So,
this is good. I've had a blast talking with you guys. You don't take yourself seriously. This is a lot of fun. And one last movie I wanted to talk about briefly.
Of course.
We talked about our favorite movies. 1944 Ray Milland movie. I don't know if you know it. I hope you do. The Uninvited.
I know it. I know all of it and have not seen it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you have to see it. It's one of the greatest, probably the greatest ghost story of the film. I just really love that. And you know, I can talk movies all day with you guys. Silent movies. I love silent movies.
Yep.
Have you ever seen The Passion of Joan of Arc?
No.
Yes. I've seen a lot of movies that typically people don't always know about because, like I said, when I was in school for film, I had to take a lot of film history courses and a lot of the classes had you watch some stuff that was off the beaten path a bit. Uh-huh. And so I'm familiar with a lot of different movies.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, and the only silent film I remember watching I didn't go for film. I went for social work, but I did take social work and film. At least I saw The Kiss with Greta Garbo.
That's cool. Great.
Yeah,
Garbo's probably my favorite my favorite silent actor, and I could talk about her all day. And then when she went into silence and she brought John Gilbert, who was by then a big drunk, and he was on the outs with the studios, and she brought him in to do, I forget the name of the movie. Queen Christina. You have to see Queen Christina. That's the one with the famous closing shot with her standing at the helm of the wheel of the ship. And the director, it might have been King Vidor, who told her, when you look out, empty your mind and think of nothing. And it's a famous closing shot with just a close-up of her. Great movie, Queen Christina, with Greta Garbo and John Gilbert.
Yeah, I'm writing this stuff down. Yeah,
that's a perfect way for us guys to close with Greta Garbo and John Gilbert and Queen Christina. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, we just want to thank you for coming on our show and talking to us for a bit here and getting to know you. We really, really appreciate your time, and we want to also plug where we can get your books. So we're going to have the links and such on our show notes and things like that. But is there anything specific you want to plug or tell the folks listening at home?
No, just get people into Other Bad Ideas and a copy of The Street. They're on Amazon. To get The Street, that's really weird. You have to look up my name under books. If you just look up my name, it won't show up for some reason. So you got to look under books, but any of my books on Amazon, not for me because I'm not going to get rich off my books, but for these small publishers that scratch and scratch every day to stay in business, buy the books and support them. I'd really appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely, folks. If you're looking for something to read, definitely pick up one of John's books. And we're going to have all the links, like I said, on our website, our show notes. So we'll make it nice and easy for you to find it. So if you search for it and you can't find it on Amazon, you just got to click the link and it will take you right there.
And if you do, double espressos on me.
Yeah. But thanks again, John. It was awesome. We got to have you back at the lunch table for movies, books, anything. You know,
anytime,
so it was really
cool. You guys want me, I'm there.
Great. Okay. We'll definitely have you back. And then I think I hear the bell ringing, so it's time to get to class.
Yep. Yep. Same time, same table.
Have a good one.
See you, buddy.
Boys and girls, lunchtime is over. For more information, visit their website at coolkidslunchtable.podbean.com. Follow the boys on all social media platforms. Just search Cool Kids Lunch Table Podcast. Now get to class before you get detention.